Morning, gentlemen. We are studying this morning Parashat Pinchas. We actually are involved in a sequel. Our Parashah really begins at the end of last week's Parashah, where we read how the plot of Bil'am to curse the Jewish people verbally failed. Instead of cursing, he blessed. And then he went to option two. Option two was to seduce Bnei Israel into immorality, knowing that God hates zima, God hates promiscuity and immodesty and immorality. So therefore he trapped us, he trapped Bnei Israel, he lured them in with the prostitutes of Midian in order to get them to sin. It was mentioned, and it's worthy to just go over it quickly, that Bil'am's anti-Semitism is actually textbook anti-Semitism. It's been the same playbook that the Goyim have been using against us from time immemorial. The Goyim go after us with two methods to try to trip us up, to try to destroy us. The first method is with hatred, with obliteration, with destruction. Like we've seen from the time of Paro, that wanted to enslave the Jewish people and kill us physically. Paro was involved in killing the infants of Bnei Israel to women and children and men of all ages. That's one form of anti-Semitism, the brutal side of it. And we've been victimized to such anti-Semitism throughout our history, whether it was in Nazi Germany of late, in our century, or the century before us, the Inquisition, or whether it was the pogroms and the blood libels that actually have manifested themselves in every single country where there was at least three Jews. There was either a pogrom, a libel, or some sort of butchering of our people. If you look in the history books, there probably is no nation that has been more victimized throughout history such as ours. I did mention on Shabbat, and it's worthy to repeat, and maybe I said it in this venue, that I do have a newspaper that I get every day, and one of the sections in the newspaper is this date in Jewish history. So I'm a student of history. I like to see what happened on any given day. And to my dismay, every single day in Jewish history commemorates another act of terror of some Jewish community somewhere in the world. And I'm following the newspaper now for 2 years, and every day they've given a different situation, a different part of the world. They don't repeat it. Which means, unfortunately, every single day on the calendar is a Tisha B'Av for the Jewish people at some point in history, at some place in history. Bil'am, being a student of Paro, being a student of his predecessors, Lavan also wanted to destroy Yaakov Avinu. As you know, Arami Oved Avi. The Hakamim tell us that this is to be taken literally. If it was up to Lavan, he would have killed Yaakov Avinu and killed his own grandchildren in order to destroy Klal Yisrael. That is not taken in an exaggerated sense. That is a literal sense. Arami Oved Avi. When the Goyim fail to kill us physically, they move into a second mode of operation. And that mode of operation is to assimilate us. They kill us by befriending us, by getting close to us, by affording us liberties and rights and freedoms, and giving us all sorts of advantages in society. And mind you, that is not as dangerous as the first anti-Semitic phase, but it is more dangerous. Because the first anti-Semitic procedure kills us physically. We die physically, but we go to Olam Haba. The second, however, is much more tenuous, is much more serious, because it assimilates the Jew. And then already the Goy robs us from our soul. He robs us from our spirituality. And therefore he not only affects our olam hazeh, but he already is playing with the most sensitive thing that we have, our olam haba. Bil'am failed to kill us physically. He got on the mountain, instead of cursing, he said, Matobu alecha Yaakov. So he said, if I can't kill them, I will love them to death. And therefore he brought in the marketplace, he brought zonot, we went shopping, they welcomed us in, we sat, we talked, and of course that situation eventually led to the assimilation of the Jewish people. It should be noted that these faces of Esav or of anti-Semitism are still around today. You must know that. Although in this country, we're enjoying the brotherly love of Esav. Baruch Hashem, at least not yet. It should never be. In this country, we're enjoying a tremendous amount of prosperity. In this country, giving us freedom of religion and rights to serve God. We do not have to censor our books. In the olden countries, before a book would be able to be printed, it needed to go to a government official and he would look through it and make sure that there was nothing written that was controversial or questionable material. And if you look at the heading of all the books, it says, written with permission of the Sultan Abdul Hamid, and they would put his name in the book, showing that it was authorized. Today, Baruch Hashem, because we have freedom of religion and freedom of press and freedom of expression and freedom of speech, so we live in an unprecedented time where the Jews have enjoyed such long prosperity and freedom for such a long time. But I want to note that this danger is a form of anti-Semitism. We shouldn't think that this is beautiful. We never had a better situation. As a result of this friendly face of brotherly love that we're enjoying, America has been responsible for the silent Holocaust. The silent Holocaust meaning over 6 million Jews have fell to assimilation and intermarriage. Now, somebody told me that they were at the Pier Village on the last Sunday night. And besides that, that there was a wedding at Pier Village. It seems they rented off the area and stuff. And he says it was very, very remarkable to see you had a priest and a rabbi, both dressed in garb, marching down the pier, down to the boardwalk. And you had a Jewish girl marrying a goy, center stage. And unfortunately, I personally was not invited, and nor did I officiate. They asked me to make the ketubah, but I said no. I didn't know the family of the hatan. In any event, you see over here, it's not documented. Meaning there is no Yad Vashem on this Holocaust, nor there is no Holocaust memorial in Washington for this silent Holocaust. But definitely, there has been major casualties as a result of this friendly face of anti-Semitism. Now, I don't know if you're on the email list for all stuff that's mailed out, but I received a very disturbing email, which it shouldn't be shocking to us, but disturbing it definitely is, regarding what's taking place today in Europe. And he writes, there's a fellow living in Europe. Yeah, now this is just to spoil all your trips to Europe. I told you, if the rabbi can't go on the trip, so he spoils it. If he's invited to go on the trip, then he says, great, good luck, you'll enjoy yourself. But I haven't been invited on any boats or any yachts or any trips like that. So therefore, as my custom is, I'm going to spoil it for everybody else who's going to go do that. But there's always next year, gentlemen. There's always next year. And we can change our opinion. From year to year, we change our opinions, as you know. So he's writing over here the following. To give you an idea of what's going on in France, where there are now between 5 and 6 million Muslims and about 600,000 Jews, here is an email that came from another Jew still in France. He writes, I am a Jew. Therefore, I am forwarding this to everyone on all my email lists. I will not sit back and do nothing. Nowhere have the flames of anti-Semitism burned more furiously than in France. In Lyon, a car was rammed into a synagogue and set on fire. In Montpellier, the Jewish religious center was firebombed. So was synagogues in Strasbourg and Marseille. So was the Jewish schools in Crete.
or recently, a Jewish sports club in Toulouse was attacked with Molotov cocktails, and on a statue of Alfred Dreyfus in Paris, the words Dirty Jew were painted. In Bondi, 15 men beat up members of a Jewish football team with sticks and metal bars. The bus that takes Jewish children to school in Aubervilliers has been attacked 3 times in the last 14 months. According to the police, Metropolitan Paris has seen 10 to 12 anti-Jewish incidents per day in the past 30 days. Wake up, world. Walls in Jewish neighborhoods have been defaced with slogans proclaiming Jews to the gas chambers and death to the Jews. A gunman opened fire on a kosher butcher's shop in Toulouse, France. A Jewish couple in their 20s were beaten up by 5 men in Villeurbanne, France. The woman was pregnant. A Jewish school was broken into and vandalized in Sarcelles, France. This was in the past week. So I call on you, whether you are a fellow Jew, a friend, or merely a person with the capacity and desire to distinguish decency from depravity, to do at least 3 simple things. First, care enough to stay informed. Don't ever let yourself become deluded into thinking that this is not your fight. I remind you of what Pastor Nemolir said in World War II. First they came for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me. And by that time, there was no one left to speak up for me. Second, boycott France and French products. Only the Arab countries are more toxically anti-Semitic, and unlike them, France exports more than just oil and hatred. Boycott their wines, their perfumes, boycott their clothes and foodstuffs, boycott their movies, definitely boycott their shores. If we are resolved, we can exert amazing pressure, and whatever else we may know about the French, we most certainly know that they are like a cobweb in a hurricane in the face of well-directed pressure. Third, send this along to your family, your friends, and to your co-workers. Think of all the people of good conscience that you know, and let them know that you and the people that you care need their help. The number one best-selling book in France is September 11th, The Frightening Fraud, which argues that no plane ever hit the Pentagon. 1930s all over again. So you see, we're living at a time where simultaneously, just as it was mailed out this week, Monday we got it, yeah. Email. So there's a lot of things taking place outside of the United States. But we're enjoying the good face of Esav, but the ugly face and the malicious face is rearing its ugly head again on other parts of the world. And therefore, as we say, Bil'am was unsuccessful in the malicious face, but he was quite successful in the assimilation, as we see. 24,000 Jews died in a plague. And our parasha begins with the sequel, that Pinhas ben Eleazar, he was able to reverse the trend. He was able to stop the plague. How? It was through an act of kana'ut, or an act we call of zealotry. He went and he took his romach, his sword, his spear, and he went in the middle of the camp where a tribal leader by the name of Zimri ben Salu was committing the unimaginable act with a goya, Kozbi Batsur, and he was with her, and he went and took his Roma. In an unprecedented act of zealotry, he stabbed them both, and at that moment, our parasha ends last week, Vata'atzar HaMagefa, and the plague abruptly came to an end. End of last week's parasha, our parasha begins. God tells Moshe, go tell Pinhas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aharon, that his act is very praised, and because of that, we're going to give him a reward, a peace covenant. The peace covenant means that Pinhas will have long life. Furthermore, he became nominated as a Kohen, even though before so he was not considered status of Kohen, so they upgraded him to the Kohen level, and he enjoyed some other perks. So the Mefarshim ask,
If Pinhas did the action in last week's parasha, why does it delay until this week's parasha to tell us that he got rewarded? Meaning, this beginning paragraph should have been last week's parasha's ending. And Pinhas took his Roma, killed Zimri ben Salu, and God came to Pinhas and said, "Azan Baru, great work. Lachen inini noten lod biriti shalom. You get the peace treaty. You get the award. Why does the Torah wait until a week later for this parasha to tell us that Pinhas, that his act was actually virtuous?" So I saw from one of the Mefarshim that says like this: zealousness and kana'ut is not always necessarily virtuous, which means not every act of zeal is proper. A lot of times you have fanatics and zealots that act out of immaturity, or they're acting out of impulsiveness, or because they have intolerance of opinion, or because they have a certain agenda, or they have a certain personal vendetta against certain people. And therefore, before you can judge the act of zealotry, you need to further observe the behavior of the zealot before you can actually assess, was it proper or wasn't it proper? Now, if we see the nature of the zealot proves to be mature and deliberate, and he's considerate of the opinions of others, then we say the zeal is proper and the zeal is commendable. And therefore the Torah says specifically, let's delay the reward. Because first we have to observe Pinhas. We have to see if his character warrants such an act of zealotry. We need time to observe Pinhas, to see his behavior, to see exactly if his zealotry was proper or improper. And therefore the Torah says, wait, don't give the reward right away. Let's take a week. Let's wait till the next parasha. And now we're able to make an assessment. The Borei Olam obviously is teaching us that zealotry on its own can be positive and it can be negative. It all depends who the zealot is, who the fanatic or who the kanai is. If it's coming from the proper motivation, then it's great. The Torah says it's deserving of reward. But if it's coming from any other agendas, then already it's not. And therefore the Torah gives us a delay to let the assessment be made on Pinhas, and then of course it was proper. Of course it was done. If you remember, I don't remember this, but I wasn't born, but in the 1960s, you had tremendous movement against the establishment. Which you call them the hippies, these fellas over here, they would wear crazy clothes. Ike was involved, I think, was one of the leadership of the movement. And you had people that were marching in Washington, and they were expressing themselves in all ways, Woodstock and all these things, and they were making a protest. They were fighting the establishment. Whatever was established, they were going against it. Against parents, against rules and regulations, against dress code. A lot of those hippies of that movement today, a lot of them are Jewish. That's always these movements are led by Jews. We know that. But a lot of those people that were in the movement then, today, are wearing suits with starched white shirts, with ties, and they have attaché cases, going to work every morning in Manhattan, in an office, and they're clean shaven, and they're fathers and mothers of beautiful families. What happened? And this zealotry over here that they were making, obviously, was coming out of immaturity, it was coming out of impulse, it was coming not from the right reasons. And you see, when they grew up and they finally got older, they abandoned all those childish things that they were involved in, and they fell into place pro-establishment. And that's the same thing over here we're discussing. Pinhas made an act of zealotry. Oh, we have to analyze. Where's this coming from? Is it proper? Is it improper? So Torah says, you know what? Let's delay a little. Let's wait and see the behavior of Pinhas outside his zealotry. And let's see if it's consistent. And let's say if he has a proper attitude, then already God says we can indeed award Pinehas. Now, further on in the parasha, we read about God, or Moshe, petitioning God to appoint a successor that will take over the leadership of Klal Yisrael after Moshe's demise. If you open the pasuk, and again I'm jumping out of order just the way I wrote them in my notes, but the Hakamim tell us in Mukdamu Meohar Torah, it says Vayomer Hashem. It's an 888. Triple eights. Vayedaber Moshe l'Hashem l'mor, yifkod Hashem Elohe aruchot l'chol basar isha l'aida. God, please appoint a man over the congregation, asher yitze lifnehem, v'asher yavo lifnehem, that he should go in front of them, go out, bring them in, v'asher yotziem, v'asher yibiem, v'lo tia adat Hashem kason asher em lahem lo'eh, and the nation should not be like a flock that has no shepherd. Moshe Rabbeinu actually was giving us a very important criteria of what makes the perfect Jewish leader. And Moshe Rabbeinu is giving us his own qualifications of what a Jewish leader must be made of. First he tells God he has to be Ish al Ha'eda. He has to be above the congregation. He has to be on top of them. When a Jewish leader is on the same level as the Kahal and is involved in the same lifestyle as the Kahal, that is not a leader. A leader is supposed to be somebody by definition that is leading, that is different, that his actions are not the same as everybody else. He does not act like everybody else in the Kahal. He has to be Ish Ala'ida. He has to be above the people. Furthermore, he says Asher Yetze V'Yavon Lifnehem, which means he must be in front of the people. He must be modeling the proper standard of behavior, which means he is the role model. Asher Yetze Lifnehem, he's in front of them. The people are supposed to look up to the leader to see exactly how to act, to see exactly what the standard of morality is supposed to be, to what the standard of ethics is supposed to be. And furthermore he says, and let the Jewish people not be like a flock of sheep that do not have a shepherd. The job of a shepherd is to take care of the welfare of the sheep. The job of a Jewish leader is to make sure that he takes care of the welfare of all the congregants. A Jewish leader cannot just lead to certain groups and certain factions. A Jewish leader must be a leader to all the factions and all the group, not to isolate himself just to an elite group and let all the other people of the Kahal fall to the wayside. He must be like a shepherd that tends to all the sheep. He doesn't only tend to the fat ones, or to the fast ones, or to the ones that, let's say, are closest to him. A shepherd has to tend to the welfare of every single sheep in his flock. So again, the three qualifications are, he has to be above the people, which means not on the same level. Number two, he has to be on a higher moral standard, an ethical standard, to model good behavior to the Kahal. And number three, he has to be involved in their welfare. We might say that this is the exact opposite of what a democracy is. In a democracy, the people elect officials. Now, the job of an elected official is to implement the will of the majority, which means it's not to lead, it's actually to be led, which means according to what the electorate wants and its constituents wants, that's already what the politician that's elected will do. Maybe that's why they're called public servants, because they're not leaders. They're actually there just to fulfill the wishes of those that put them in office. Hence, before any major decision is made in government, there's polling that's done to see exactly which way the wind is blowing, to see if the majority is with them or against them. If they're with them, they proceed. If they're against them, they abandon the opinion.
So there's no leadership over here. It's a group of men that are being led by those that place them in office. However, Jewish people, Israel, was not intended to be a democracy. In Judaism, the leadership is really what's called a theocracy. A theocracy is where the leader is bound, not by the will of people, but by the divine law, by the Torah and its principles. And it's not subject to a vote by the majority. Which means if the majority of the Kahal decides that they want to start being lax in a certain mitzvah, and the rabbi's being hired by the committee, and the committee now is voting that this is the policy, but it's anti-Torah. It's not for the leader now to come along and say, well, you know, my job is in jeopardy, therefore, you know, I'll give in to this. It's not the rabbi's law that he can compromise it. The rabbi and the leader's job is to execute the law of the divine, of God himself, and therefore that's what we call a theocracy. It's led by God through the leaders, and therefore, the rabbi must set the standard. And even if it's difficult, and take it from somebody that knows a little about the rabbinate, it is very difficult when you try to set standards for a kahal, and the kahal is not understanding. There is not to cater to the desires of the members. It's the job of the leader to set the policy and the standard where they acquiesce and fall into place according to the level that's set before them. The Gemara at the end of Sotah tells us some telltale signs of what the generation before Mashiach is going to look like. And one of these signs is Pnei Hador Kifnei HaKelev. The Mishnah tells us that the face of the generation, the face of Jewish leadership at the end of time is going to be like the face of a dog. Now they're not talking about the complexion or the good looks or bad looks of the leaders. They're saying the policies. Which means, if a person is walking a dog, so of course the person that's walking the dog stands behind, and the dog walks ahead. At first glance, it looks like the dog is leading the owner. Right, but when do we know, at what point do you know who really is leading who? When they get to a fork in the road, when they get to a corner, and the dog doesn't know should he turn right or turn left. So he turns his head back to look at the master, and the master signals either to right or left. The Gemara says at the times of the Mashiach, Pnei Hador Kifnei HaKelev, Jewish leadership is going to look like that they're leading. It's going to look like as if they're in front of the Kahal. They're going to get up and make speeches and fire and brimstone, and you're going to say, oh, this is a Kahal over here that has true guidance and true direction. However, it's Pnei Hador Kifnei HaKelev. When is the truth going to come out? When there's a certain controversy in the Kahal, and a certain question, and now the leader is not going to know, should he go right or go left? So what does he do? He turns back to the committee. He turns back to the congregation and says, which way do you want me to go? Which side do you want me to take? Should I take the right or the left? Then we see already who's leading who. It looks like the Caliph is leading, but it's not. It's really the guy behind them. It's going to look like Jewish leadership is in charge, but it's really not true. It's a hoax. It's a facade. It's really who's behind them. And that's what the Gemara says in Ketubot, in the name of Abaye. Hai Tsurban Rabbanan, this young rabbi, the Merahamin Le Bene Mata, that is beloved and endeared by his congregation, Lav Mishum B'Mahale Tafeh. It's not because he's necessarily good. Ela Mishum B'Lo Mukhah Lehu B'Mile Dishmaya. It's because he's not rebuking them. It's because he's not making anybody uncomfortable. Which means if a rabbi is enjoying good poll ratings, it's not necessarily because he's a great man. It's because he might be delinquent. That therefore, of course, a community loves a rabbi that's passive, that doesn't ruffle any feathers and doesn't make anybody feel uncomfortable. And he gets up at every speech and says, the kahal is great, the community is great, and it's sunny day outside, and the summer's beautiful, and everybody have a good time. And everybody comes out of speech and says, you know, I feel good. And therefore, everybody says, you know what, that's a real rabbi. The Abaye says, don't fool yourself. That those good ratings do not prove proper leadership. On the contrary, it proves delinquency.
because that means the leader is not doing his job. A rabbi always has to be in that fine balance of maintaining equilibrium in the Kahal, but at the same time, elevating the Kahal and bringing them to the next level. I've told you many times of Yisrael Salanter's statement on Jewish leadership. He said that a rabbi that his community does not want to oust him is not a rabbi. But then he said, but any rabbi that was ousted is not a human being. Which means the rabbi must know the fine line, how to elevate the Kahal to a higher state, but at the same time, he needs to retreat from time to time to give the Kahal a chance to digest, to give it a time for the Kahal to accept. He shouldn't come out every week firing away with Musad and firing brimstone, and all it is every week the speech is just an opportunity to lambast the Kahal. Of course, from time to time, the rabbi's obligation is to correct things. But it has to be done with a certain amount of wisdom. It has to be done, you take 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, 1 forward, 1 back. It has to be done by chokhmah. And that's what Yisrael Salanter said. If the rabbi eventually gets ousted, it's his fault, because he didn't play it right. Because he was too strict, because he was too tough. He didn't give the kahal any breathing room. He choked them. And that's what the Torah is telling us. Moshe Rabbeinu was saying, remember, the leader has to be in front of the kahal. And in front of the kahal means in front leading. Not in front with his head turned back, looking for direction and guidance. I saw a nice thought brought down from one of the Chachamim, which is a novel idea, it's truly a novel concept. Moshe Rabbeinu, we know, was punished that he couldn't go into Eretz Yisrael because of last week's episode of the hitting of the rock. Of course, that's the most conventional interpretation, and the Mefarshim explained that at the hitting of the rock, what was the sin of the hitting of the rock? Harambam understands it was because he got angry. He lost his cool. He hit the rock, he screamed at the people, Shimonah, Morin, and therefore because of that flaw, Hazal Shalom, that minor character flaw in Midot, in character, so Moshe Rabbeinu lost his ability to take Klal Yisrael into Israel. But I saw another interpretation, which is just as valid. Until this point of the hitting of the rock, Moshe Rabbeinu was the advocate par excellence for the Jewish nation. No matter what the Jewish people did, Moshe Rabbeinu always would put his neck on the front line to defend anything and everything of Klal Yisrael. The Jewish people were in Egypt. Moshe Rabbeinu comes on the scene, he comes to Paro, the biggest anti-Semite of the time, and he petitions Paro for the release of Klal Yisrael. Instead of it getting lighter, it intensifies. Moshe Rabbeinu now risks his life and goes to Borei Olam and he starts to complain, not for himself, but for the people. Lama hare'ota la'am hazeh. Why did you do bad for your people? Ume'az bati el paro ledaber b'shmecha. From the time that I've come to Paro, you've only done bad. You didn't save the people. The Gemara says at that point the angels told God, you let him talk to you that way? The angels wanted to kill Moshe. How can you let him talk to you like that? What is he in a restaurant? That's not what I ordered, and I want this. Well, you're talking to God over there. You said you're going to save them, now you're killing them. But Borei Olam says, leave them. Leave him. He's not crying for himself. He feels the pain of his brethren so much that he feels as if he's being tortured and he's being enslaved. Therefore, his empathy is praiseworthy. Moshe Rabbeinu after the Egel, where God vowed, I am going to destroy the Jewish nation and Moshe will start your career again from scratch. Moshe Rabbeinu says, Mecheni na misifrecha shel katafta. If you're going to do away with their career, do away with my career as well. Erase me from the Torah. Moshe, in ultimate leadership, says, I will go down with the ship. And therefore Moshe Rabbeinu was considered the great leader, even sacrificing himself, until the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's career. Obviously, Moshe Rabbeinu from day to day was growing in Kedusha. To the end of his life, the Pasuk writes, V'zot ha-beracha asher berach Moshe ish ha-Elohim. The end of the Torah refers to Moshe as a man of God. The Gemara says at the end of his life he was half man, half angel, which means he elevated himself to Kedusha of a Malach, which is already he was part human being, part angelic. No human being ever elevated himself. Usually you're an Ish or you're a Malach. Moshe was Ish HaElohim. He was split. He had the Malach and he had a human side to it. Moshe Rabbeinu was celibate for a large part of his life after Matan Torah for 40 years. Furthermore, on three occasions, he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights and went up to the heavens and was with God. And as Moshe Rabbeinu got older, his ties with the physical needs, they became much less. In that context, we understand the story of the hitting of the rock. The Jewish people come along and they're thirsty. And they come along and complain to Moshe. And they come along and say, we need water. Granted. Baruch Abba Yosef. It's good to see you. Baruch Abba Yosef. It's clear that the Jewish people had a lack of faith. There's no question. They should have trusted in God and said the same one that took us out of Egypt. He'll give us water and he'll provide for us. But what was Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction? When they started to complain about lack of water, which is a vital necessity, they weren't complaining there wasn't strawberry shortcake. They weren't complaining they didn't have, a caviar. They were complaining on a vital necessity of life. They needed to quench their thirst. And what was Moshe Rabbeinu's reaction? How dare they complain about water? Where's their emunah? Where's their faith? Instead, if Moshe Rabbeinu was like he was 40 years before, he would have defended Klal Yisrael. He would have told God, listen, they're thirsty. It's still the same Moshe that can defend idolatry of Avodah Zarah. The same Moshe that defended them against all the other complaints. Now the son of Moshe Rabbeinu finds himself chastising the people because they want water. At that point, Borei Olam said, it's time for change. So long as Moshe Rabbeinu was able to identify himself with the needs of the people, so then already, you deserve to be the leader. Which means, we know the people are not perfect. But the leader has to understand that while the people have certain needs, especially a basic need like water, so as long as Moshe Rabbeinu was all human, before he reached Ish HaElohim, he could be the leader. But once after the story of the Memeribah, where Moshe Rabbeinu did not defend Klai, on the contrary, he got angry at them for asking for water. Moshe, God says, now already it's time for change. We need a leader that can understand the earthly needs of Klai Yisrael. So it's actually a compliment to Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu, now you're deserving to be a leader over the Malachim. Because you're a Malach now. But you can't have a Malach leading human beings. And therefore, Yeshua is called Ish Asher Ruach Bo. He understood the spirit of each individual, which means every human being. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu's punishment, it's really a compliment. God's telling Moshe Rabbeinu, you've elevated yourself so much, you're now suitable to lead a group of angels. But to lead a group of human beings, because you're a Mal'ach, you cannot even understand what water is. You cannot even understand what a basic need is. You're getting angry at them because they're thirsty. Moshe Rabbeinu, Chazak Baruch, you've graduated. You've reached a new plateau in your life. We have to appoint somebody else, Asher Ruach Bo, that still has the spirit of humanity in him, that can lead the people according to all their needs. So it wasn't necessarily a punishment, but it was actually a promotion for Moshe Rabbeinu. From here we learn that not only as leaders, but as people, we must empathize with the needs of every Jew. There's a great rabbi called the Tzaddik from Sanz. He used to give charity out to people that would come to him. So one day his wife came to him and said, do you know that lady that you give charity to? I saw her in the butcher shop using the money that you gave her to buy duck. You believe it? She's buying duck, which is a great delicacy. So the Tzaddik from San says, I'm glad you're telling me, because now I know that duck is one of her needs. And therefore, I must make sure that she has enough money to buy duck.
which means the rabbi was such a tzaddik, he empathized with everybody according to their level. Well, she must have been a rich lady, and she was accustomed to such a life. She says, I'm glad you're telling me this. Maybe I wasn't giving her enough to fulfill that need. Now, I'm not saying to be so compassionate, maybe like the tzaddik from Sanz, but this concept of feeling somebody else's need and sorrow and empathy must be a midah, not only for the leader, but for everybody. Our Torah tells us in the Perasha about the daughters of Selofhad that came to Moshe Rabbeinu and they asked for an inheritance in the land of Israel. They came along and said, our father died in the Midbar. He was not part of the rebellion against Korah. Kibihat Omet. He died from his own sin. Lamma nigara. Why should we lose out now? Because the inheritance went to the father, and the father would now divvy it out to the children. Being now that they had no father, and they were girls, and girls by law do not inherit, so therefore they were going to lose out on inheritance in Eretz Yisrael. I saw one cute idea. What does Moshe Rabbeinu answer them? I got to go ask God. Mm-hmm. He took their case and he took it in front of God. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu rule it himself? So I saw a story they tell about the great rabbi called the Minhat Chinuch. The Minhat Chinuch, Rabbi Yosef Babad. They came to him once, two litigants for a court case. So before they were ready to give the case to the rabbi, one of the litigants tells the rabbi and says, do you know something? Your father, Rabbi, officiated at my wedding. Oh. So the rabbi turns to the other litigant and says, did my father officiate at your wedding as well? He says, no. So the rabbi said, I'm pasul, I cannot judge you. Because already now, I'm biased now. Already you're saying that I'm connected, my father did you a favor, I'm out, you gotta get a different rabbi. That's how honest Achim you were. If the other rabbi, if the other litigant had his father at his wedding, also equal, I can continue the case. So he says, that's what I'm with Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, here's the case of the Menot Selofhad. In the argument, what do they tell him? And you should know, our father died, but he wasn't involved in the rebellion of Korach.
I was on your side.
That's a bribery right there. Which is that really? It's like, listen, he was with you. Oh, but the Kram Moshe Mishpatel of Nazir says, I'm not, I can't judge you. You're ready, you bribed me. He says, we got to bring this case. That line of Korah, that already was for sale Moshe Rabbeinu. He felt that that's considered a bribery. It should be pointed out. Why does he have to point that out? This is how he died. I mean, they felt that that was pertinent to the case that they presented. Just say, our father died. If it's a difference if he died of a heart attack, or he got hit by a camel, or a piece of mount fell on his head, what's the difference how he died? The point is that he's not around anymore, we want inheritance. But they're very specific the way they say it. He wasn't part of Korah, Kibihat Omet. So I saw a beautiful explanation according to the halakha. The law is like this, that if somebody dies because from the king, so all his assets are frozen and they go to the king. Which means when a melech, when a king, he executes somebody because of a royal death sentence, so that puts a eminent domain on all his property, and all his property now goes to the melech. Now, when those people were fighting against Korach, that was a mutiny against the king. Moshe Rabbeinu was the melech. If he dies because of the sin of Korach, then Selofhad has no assets. All his assets belong to Moshe, and therefore there is no claim for any property. Your father has no rights. Your father relinquished his rights. His property now belongs to the government. So she has to have to be very careful. He died for a private sin, and therefore he didn't relinquish his assets, his property, and therefore we're asking to get a chelek. So the question is like this, and we'll conclude with this. The question is, not the question, but the Midrash says over there something beautiful. The Midrash says like this. There were three people in their time that did a good deed, and they took credit not only for their action, but they got credit for the whole generation.
The first example was Noah. Noah was told by God to build the Teba because of an imminent flood that was coming. So he went and he built the Teba. And nobody else in the generation heeded the call of Noah or the call of God. So the Midrash says, Noah, you get sachar keneged kulam. Which means your sachar is not individual. It's compounded by however many people living in your generation. You take all their sachar. It's like the first guy that comes to the minyan. Doesn't he get sachar keneged everybody else that follows him? Yeah. So Noah, you get credit for your zikud and all the potential reward that couldn't be given out to everybody else, you get it for yourself. Yeah. Abraham. That's a concept. I understand that concept, no?
Not clearly. In other words, Noah, the people were bad.
Correct. But Noah was good.
Right.
So Noah gets his credit, and he gets credit for all the bad people that did not heed to the word of Noah. So he gets sachar keneged kulam. If they would have listened, they also would have been saved. And they also would have got reward.
Right.
But they didn't. So all that reward that was supposed to be given out to everybody
like
else, he gets everybody's.
Okay.
Abraham Avinu, you were living at a time when there was paganism. And you came along and preached monotheism. And you went around, and you were one against everybody else. So you get credit for yourself, for your own invention. And you get sachar keneged kulam.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one in this elite group, Benot Selof Had. Benot Selof Had, you came along and asked for a chelik and Eretz Yisrael, and therefore you get credit for everybody else that didn't. So the Mefarshim explained what this Midrash is really saying. What do you mean? Everybody else that didn't. What's the comparison between Noah and Abraham and Benot Selof Had? I said Noah was one man against the whole generation. Abraham was one man against the whole generation. Benot Selof Had, were they against the generation? No, they were just coming for a real estate proposition over here. They weren't fighting City Hall over here. They weren't fighting anybody else. So the interpretation is they were. Because this episode happened right after the story where the Jewish people were complaining, the Tenaros Venashuba Mesraima. Everybody at this point in Jewish history, the sentiment of Klal Yisrael was, Eretz Yisrael is a bad thing. We want to go back to Egypt, to Midbar, we had it better off over there, the menu was better, the living conditions were better, we don't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. At a time where the sentiment towards Eretz Yisrael was bad, which means if you took a poll at that point, 90% of the people would tell you, Israel, no good, we just finished the story of the spies. And would have been Benot Selof Had come along? They're complaining at that point, we want a piece of the land. The Midrash says, at a time where the public opinion is anti-Israel, and you're coming along against the tide, and you're saying, you want a piece of the land? Your sachar is keneged kulam. You get credit, keneged everybody. From here, Rav Mordechai Ilan learns a great lesson. That from here you see, a mitzvah is rewarded on two fronts. Number one, for the mitzvah, but number two, and more importantly, the timing that you did the mitzvah. Which means, if you're living at a time, such as we are, where honesty and integrity in the marketplace is non-existent, unfortunately. You have to look far and beyond to find people that are nosev and noten be'emunah. It's very common that you hear from business people that you cannot make a living if you're honest. You have to be a certain amount, a little tricky or compromising in your integrity. In a generation where the mode of operation of business is to angle and to cut and to cheat and to steal. In a generation where you have an honest businessman, which is you could have that same honest businessman, put him in a different generation where that's the normal thing, he'll get credit. But he doesn't get credit like he would in a generation as ours. Even if we take it on a broader sense, religion. In our generation, especially, let's say, in the summer months, religious Jews, Orthodox Jews, observant Jews, have a little harder test than they might have all year long. Being that we're in the summer, and the general nature of the world is a little more laxity. People a little more open, and they're enjoying themselves, and their standard is not the same. Maybe the dress level falls a little, maybe the observance and going to minyan, it's not the same like in the winter, it's not the same level of learning. And there were those that maintain the madriga of religion in the summer, when you have a whole sect of the community that has abandoned such values, so your sakhar is that much greater. But you have a girl. All year long, she's impeccably modest. And she's careful to wear everything the proper way according to halakha. Now she comes to the summer. And she even sees that by the religious people, okay, they're not a little more careful, a little shorter, a little lower, a little this. You know, it's the summer. Everybody's relaxed. To keep the same standard, to be modest in the winter when everybody's bundled up, you get reward. It's great. It's a lot of credit. But to maintain the same standard when everybody else is lightening up and you're tightening, that already is sakhar, keneged kulam. And therefore, we have to feel a little proud or good about ourselves, because in truth, we are like salmon. We are swimming against the stream. We are not the majority. For Jewish men to come on a Friday on a day off, to spend 2-3 hours in the beginning of their morning in the synagogue, it's not the norm. How do I know it's not the norm? Because if it was the norm, there'd be 50,000 people over here. And maybe you say, Rabbi, it's not the only shul. But I'm sure if you go take a survey of all the shuls, you don't have 50,000 members of the community that are sitting on the front, people who took off, of course, that are sitting and learning 2 hours. Me alone, day off. Hey, get up a little later. If I have to put on my tefillin at home, and like they say, you pray by the kote, you pray by the wall, and then I go to the beach to relax. And that doesn't mean that we're not allowed to relax, but at least we have an understanding of priority, of understanding of obligation. And this class is given 52 weeks a year, by the way. We don't miss. Every Friday we give a class. But you can't imagine the reward that we get for the class during the 11 weeks of the summer than to the 35 weeks of the winter. In the winter, it's a Friday, it's cold anyway, it's a different head. Which means you're more in a scholastic brain, or in an academic brain. But in the summer, it's much looser. And therefore, to maintain the level, even when everybody else is loosening, that's noter sakhar, keneged kulam. So we can argue and say we're very fortunate to be this generation. You know, we always question ourselves, if we were only born in the generation of the Tanaim, if we could only live in the times of the Amoraim, when everybody was religious, everybody was doing the right thing, when there was prophets around, when there was a Beit HaMikdash, yes, I don't argue. Very advantageous to live in such a holy generation. But you know what? There's a great advantage to live in our generation, because now we get bonus points. Which means if everybody's religious in the times of Beit HaMikdash, you're like everybody else. You get 1 point. But now that everybody else, well, I should say not everybody, but there's a majority of the flow is going in a different direction. And we are swimming the other way. So now God gave us a great opportunity. Now our religious observance is paid double and triple and quadruple points. We're like Noah in the times of the floods. We're like Abraham in the times of the paganists. And we're like Benotzen of Hat. When everybody's burning the Israeli flag, they're coming along and saying, we want to go to Eretz Israel. They get sakhar, keneged kulam. They get the sakhar, keneged everybody. And therefore, it's a little motivation that we have to stay the course. There was one rabbi that had a meeting with a priest. So when he went into the meeting, this is a true story. The priest said to him, obviously you're Jewish. Jewish rabbi. Obviously you're Jewish. He said, no, I'm a Protestant. The priest was shocked. A Protestant? So he says, what does a Protestant mean? Protestant was originally, there was a group in Christianity that protested against what Christianity stood for. So they created a group called Protestants, which means the group that protested the establishment. He says, I'm a Protestant. Whatever society is doing, I protest. I'm against it. But that's a Protestant. And so the rabbi went on to say, he said, listen, somebody once asked me, what did Avraham Avinu wear? Which means, did he wear a strimo? Did he have peor? Did he have a fez cap? Did he have a bekesher? Did he have a tarbut? Did he have a jibbe? What exactly was the clothes of Avraham Avinu? So the rabbi said, I don't know what he was wearing. But one thing I can tell you for sure, whatever everybody else was wearing, he was wearing the opposite. That's for sure. And that's
the lesson over here of greatness. To become great in a generation that everybody's doing the same thing, that's praiseworthy. But really great and really praiseworthy is when you're able to go against the tide and against the stream. That is the true character. And that's what the Pasuk is saying over here. Benotzen of Had, you get reward because you did it at a time where the sentiment toward the land of Israel was negative. And you came along and said, these people are crazy. You're negative about Eretz Yisrael. Not, we claim we want to get Eretz Yisrael. We want to get a piece of Eretz Yisrael. So Nofha's daughters get Zachak and Eretz Kulam. Baruch Allah Le'olam. Amen. Bi'ach Ananam B'Kashar Amen. Sarah Barakos, you got to say, Lefikha, Kevon, Lefayimah, Ma'achafes, Ma'atzit Koyidit, Torah, B'Yadid.